Welcome to the datascience.la podcast. Hadley Wickham is famous. He's not Kardashian famous, but walking around USAR and seeing the community's reaction to him, there's no question, he's R famous. If you have the good fortune to see his talks, tutorials, or sessions in person, you owe it to yourself to do so. He projects depth and wisdom with a booming voice, which combines with a hard-won confidence brought about by years of honing his craft and developing his expertise. He takes as much time as is needed to answer questions, listens to every single bit of feedback, and succeeds in making you feel that what you say indeed matters. Hadley Wickham has poise. It is also quite obvious, if you watch him for long enough, that this fame suits him like an itchy sweater made by a loving grandparent. It brings warmth, and it comes from a place of love, but it's always a little uncomfortable, regardless of how well it may fit. Hadley and I had a long-ranging interview at USAR 2014, discussing our strengths and revealing its weaknesses together. We reveal Hadley's evil plans for world domination, as well as his not-so-evil plans to help users better manage their workflow. Enjoy this conversation.
That's how I got to actually know about R, is through the Hadleyverse, as people call it. Mm-hmm. You probably most famous for ggplot, if not dplyr. Mm-hmm. Of those packages, is there anything in particular that you're really particularly proud of?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, like, to me, the thing that gets me most excited is this sort of, like, I see this vision of how data analysis should be and how I can help people do data analysis where they don't have to fight the tools. It just naturally helps them solve the problems that they're interested in. And I'm like, that what gets me really excited and is just seeing what people do with it. Like, I love the ggplot2 mailing list. It's like such a fantastic resource, and like on Stack Overflow there's just so many people like helping other people use the tools I've created. It's tremendously satisfying.
Internationally. I mean, yes. When you go to Stack Overflow, it's incredible. I mean, it's a United Nations of people trying to analyze and understand data. So on that point, though, so you're opinionated. You have an opinion about how it is that the entire process should be managed.
Yep.
Where did you develop that opinion?
It's sort of really interesting. Like, when I started my PhD at Iowa State, I taught a couple of R courses for a company, and they kind of like provided a curriculum. And looking back, I looked back on those slides a few years ago, and it made me realize, like, all of the bits that I thought were particularly frustrating and didn't have any nice underlying theory were, like, things I ended up working on. And the other thing that was really influential is at Iowa State, my assistantship for my PhD was doing consulting, so I'd help PhD students with their statistics problems. So I sort of had, like, you know, working on two or three different small statistics problems every week. And that just made me, like, realize how much of the problem of doing statistics is not like the statistics itself. It's getting the data in, getting in the right form, visualizing it so you get some idea, and then, like, the final model is often like the easiest part of the process.
Yeah, no, when I'm programming in R, that's one thing I notice is that 90% of the code is getting the data to the point where I can do something useful with it. A lot of what you're doing with your modules and with your code, I almost see as a domain-specific language for different facets of the data process.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny to me. You almost seem to use R as a runtime environment upon which to build your domain-specific language. Is that a conscious decision?
Yeah, very much so. Like, I think one of the things I like about R is because it is such a great host environment for domain-specific languages. And I think there's a lot of, like, data analysis that you can tackle with this sort of domain-specific algebra, a domain-specific language, or an algebra, or a grammar, like, where you think about what are the component pieces and how do you join them together. And I really like this approach to solving problems where you have, like, very, very simple building blocks. You have a way of combining them together, and then that, each piece is easy to understand by itself, but you can join them together into something very complex and flexible that allows you to solve a lot of problems. But equally, like, you don't want to try and solve every problem. If you try and solve every problem, then the domain-specific language doesn't really help you.
It's not a domain.
Yeah, exactly. and so equally, like, I think something that makes, you know, like, dplyr and reshape or tidyr and ggplot successful is because I can capture like the most common 80% of tasks, but for the other 20%, you can do anything. You know, you're in a programming language. There's thousands of other packages you can use, and that makes it possible because I can rely on that, because I can rely on, you know, thousands of other people's work, and to handle this kind of massive long tail. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of try and focus on like what are the most common problems that the vast majority of people using R experience.
Okay. That makes sense. One of the things that I think is interesting you just said is that you said that R is specifically a great environment for hosting domain-specific mm-hmm. languages. You're writing a fantastic book right now, The Advanced R Programming. It's clearly an advanced book. Mm-hmm. It is not it's not an introduction.
Yep.
And in it, you tackle the remember the term, the non-standard evaluation.
Yep.
Coming from a traditional computer science background, non-standard evaluation was a great surprise to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You use it a great deal.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of the features that you would point to as one of your favorite features of R.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me about what are some aspects of R that set it aside, set it apart? What are your favorite bits?
I mean, I think it's interesting that it is an extremely flexible language. And if you're a programmer coming from another language and you can kind of see, like, you can take an object, an S3 object, and you can change it to an arbitrary class, you're like, you know, that's horrible.
It's wrong.
But I kind of think, like, most... The way I sort of think of it is like, you know, many, like programming languages kind of provide contracts, right? These are the things you can do, these are the things you can't do. And in many programming languages, that's kind of like a legal contract. It spells out explicitly like what you can and you cannot do. And the things you can't do, there's no way you can do them.
It's oftentimes seen as a feature of the language.
Yes, exactly. Whereas R, it's more like a contract between friends. Like you're kind of like, you know, you really shouldn't do this. But if you really want to, you know, you can go ahead and do it anyway. So there's a lot of things that... you know, they're not great programming practice, and you don't want to do them 95% of the time, but the 5% of the time that you need them, that's really, really useful. And I think there's a lot of parallels between, like, R and C++. Like, C++ is an incredibly powerful programming language. You can do, you know, all sorts of crazy and dangerous and bad things with it, and that's used as and people use that as a reason not to use it. But you can also write, you know, C++ code that's relatively simple and understandable, and you just keep these kind of the crazy magic constrained to a well-defined area, and then you could take advantage of the simplicity 95% of the time, but you can still always escape the constraints mm-hmm. and do what you really want to the other 5% of the time.
So ggplot is this fantastic tool that allows for visualization, mm-hmm. but ggplot 2. You've recently started talking a great deal about ggviz.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to me sort of the cognitive model and the evolution in your understanding of visualization that has taken you from ggplot to ggviz?
So I think there's kind of one like general trend, and that is like everything is moving to the web. Like anything that can move to the web will move to the web. And generally, like when you look at kind of cross-platform graphics rendering systems, there's so much work going on in browsers and making them fast and competing. And if you want to do like cross-platform interactive graphics, like it's so clear that the browser is where you want to be. And I've worked on other projects in the past, like GGobi and our package called Cranvas, which, you know, work at quite a low level with like the graphics system on the computer. The challenge, those are like incredibly, incredibly fast, but the challenge is like getting everything compiling on every possible system so that you can easily use it on your computer. And certainly like that kind of stuff is great for like special purpose where you're willing to invest time in getting the software up and running. But, you know, if you can't, from my perspective, if you can't download a package from CRAN and start using it right away, then that's too hard for most people. And so those sort of things, like that, those sort of intersections, like the web graphics are not necessarily fast, although they're getting faster all the time, but they're so much easier to distribute. And with, you know, sort of the integration of ggviz and Shiny and the ability to, like, host the arbitrary visualizations that use arbitrary R code, so though somewhere a server has to be running R,
something.
But most people can just look at it from their web browser, they can use it on their iPad, the iPhone, whatever, and they can just use that visualization without having to understand or care about what's on the back end.
So you, I believe your title is Chief Scientist?
Yes.
At our studio. It's a pretty cool sounding title.
Yes.
Our studio is pushing sort of this move to the web to a degree.
Yes.
What's your job like at our studio as the Chief Scientist, and does it basically involve this entire motion towards the web?
To some extent, I mean, my position at our studio is kind of a research and development position. I sort of think of, like, my job is to make R more awesome.
Cool.
So, you know, I don't have any responsibility to sell our studio or to make our studio better, but, you know, obviously the better R is, the more people use R, the more people use our studio, the more people use our commercial products. I think as a company, like, we're definitely, like, so heavily invested in the web. I mean, one thing that you don't notice with the RStudio IDE, and that the RStudio IDE is just, it's all HTML and JavaScript and CSS, and that's why, you know, you can use RStudio server remotely and you just connect it through a web browser and it looks exactly the same as when you use the IDE. And that's because the local IDE is basically just a bundled web browser that views the RStudio web application. And I think that that's really cool, and that gives us a lot of capability to embed arbitrary web components inside the IDE, and we've started to see that with the viewer pane.
Yeah.
I just saw some nice integration, very beta stuff in terms of displaying our markdown documents in the pane so you can see them alongside the document you're editing. You know, because it's just a web browser, you can stick arbitrary HTML anywhere in the RStudio IDE, and I think we've only just started to explore what that means.
So that's a pretty smart architectural decision. There's so much money and effort going into hardware-accelerated canvases and all of these technologies, you know, faster DOM, that you guys are just going to be able to piggyback on that.
Yeah. Exactly.
So if your position is a research and development position, that gives you some leeway to think about bigger pictures.
Yeah.
What are the bigger picture challenges that you think you're going to be working on in the next couple of years?
So I think in the short term, it's just getting this, like, pipeline of data analysis from, like, loading your data, tidying your data, visualizing your, manipulating your data and visualizing your data, and just making sure, like, every piece fits together, have a consistent interface, it's fast. You know, one of the things that's had a profound impact on my development of tools is RCPP and being able to write C++ code that's really nice, really fast. And just so just like getting that pipeline from raw data to a visualization absolutely solid is something that, like, in the short term I'm working on heavily. I think in the longer term, the one thing that kind of the Hadleyverse doesn't really tackle at all at the moment is modeling.
Mm-hmm.
And there's obviously a huge amount of really great modeling software in R and implementing every model you can possibly imagine. But to me, there's still a lot that the model building process, that iteration where you, like, fit a model, you plot it somehow, you look at the residuals, you look at predictions, and then use that to inform the next visualization, that currently feels kind of clunky to me. And at some point I'd like to think about how can we build better tools for that. And then I think generally the other shift, I think, is sort of looking at, like, big data.
Mm-hmm.
And my sort of impression of where the field is going is that by and large most data scientists will not have to worry about that. Exactly. What will happen is you will buy some kind of analytics database, which will be like a cluster of computers. They have shared memory. The main interface to it is SQL, but also embedded in that database will be a number of kind of the most common and most important modeling tools. So R is and always will be like an unparalleled environment for exploratory analysis of your data, but it's fundamentally all about in-memory data.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. And there's a lot of things you can do with in-memory data you can't do with out-of-memory data. You can never get that, like, really fluid exploration. So like, I think, like, broader, there's this iteration between, like, you getting some subset of the data, whether it's like an aggregate or a sample or a summary, into R. You do some exploration, then you want to talk to the the system that has all of the data and ask it to do something more sophisticated. Maybe it's going to fit linear models or random forests or support vector machines or something, and then get the result of those, pull them back into R, introspect them, use that to inform kind of the next step, and so on and so on. And so like, you know, there's some baby steps in that direction with dplyr, which can talk to databases and translate your R expressions into SQL, so that you don't have this big cognitive cost of switching languages, which is really, really painful. You know, not because R and SQL are so different, but because they're so similar, except there's like a few really frustrating differences.
Right. It would almost be better if they genuinely were different.
Yes, definitely.
So one of the things that... So the first time I was exposed to R was during my wife's doctoral dissertation. Mm-hmm. She actually taught, I think, one of the first classes using RStudio at the university level. Two months after RStudio was released, she taught a doctoral statistics class. And when I saw R coming from 30 years of computer programming, I was genuinely horrified.
Yeah.
It was like, there's no dynamic memory allocation, it didn't fit. And one of the things that was hard for me to understand was that computer programming isn't necessarily software engineering.
Yeah.
And it was only once I actually began to understand this entire interactive method, this idea of a loaded environment with memory, with data, and the programmer, the data scientist, actually actively working in the REPL loop, I saw the value of R.
Yep.
So it sounds like you believe that that's going to be how data scientists continue working in the future, in this sort of interactive exploratory
method. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think R is really interesting because there's sort of a tension between R as an environment for interactive data analysis, where basically you want to be able to iterate as quickly as possible. It can sort of do some magic to guess what you want. If it guesses wrong, you know, you find out right away because you're always looking at your data. But then there's also R as a programming language where you want everything to be like explicit, you want things to fail right away, to never guess if something doesn't match up quite right, it should say, I don't know what's going on, I'm going to try and fix it for you, I'm going to throw an error. And that, like, I found that thinking about that tension really helpful. Like, some functions are designed to be used interactively, some functions are designed to be used by other programmers, and you want to do things a little bit differently in those two environments. But the majority of people using R are not programmers, or they don't, at least they don't self-identify as programmers, even though they are doing programming. Or scripting.
Yeah.
And I think that is, like, I think generally we're going to see a lot more of that, like, that sort of programming is such an incredibly important skill for almost anyone in any facet of life, regardless of, you know, whether you want to be a historian or you want to be a scientist or, you know, whatever. You need to have these computing tools that allow you to, you know, explore data or explore your domain without having to have this, you know, hardcore programming background, without having to understand, like, memory allocation, how computers work in a fundamental level. And I think that, like, to me, like, the combination of kind of computing and data is sort of transformative. Like, that, it's a really powerful motivation to learn computing. And sort of my experience is it's so much fun, like, to teach a course about computing where you basically start with visualization. You just throw people in the deep end. Like, this is how you can create plots. And it's so motivating because now you can take a data set and start to understand what's going on.
Yeah. What you're saying really resonates with me. I have a 13-year-old son who has been exposed to me as a programmer the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never shown really any interest. Because it looks boring when you're in VI writing some Perl code. Yeah. That's not going to motivate a 13-year-old. Yeah. Something happened when I shifted from that kind of programming to more data scientist style programming, that suddenly my son would come up to me and ask me questions. He would point at things, and what really shocked me is that every once in a while he would bring an insight that I genuinely had overlooked. So there's something to what you're saying about this idea that this exploratory programming, this exploratory paradigm is going to be transformative. Do you think the tools are there? Where are we on the evolution?
I think we're still fairly early days. You know, I mean, R has a 30-year history, basically. There's a lot of, you know, mistakes that have been made that cannot be unmade. It, The challenge is, though, like, this kind of only, there's only bad solutions. Like, you can, if you start afresh, if you start with a new programming language, like Julia, which is clearly a fantastic programming language.
For programmers, it's amazing.
But there's no, like, none of the packages you need to do data analysis are there. And it's going to take, it takes a long time for a new language to catch up like that. And I think Julia's, you know, doing really well at building a community around that. But so that's one choice, is to kind of start afresh, and then you have to start from scratch, which is both good and bad. On the other hand, and sort of more what I'm doing is, like, how far can we push R? How far can we take it? How can we make it a terribly flexible language? You know, how can we help people use the good parts of it and avoid the bad parts? And I think we've seen this sort of a similar evolution with JavaScript. Like, mm-hmm. You know, there's this famous book by Douglas Crockwood, JavaScript, The Good Parts. Like, you can take a programming language that people think is horrible and awful, and you can scope out the nice part of it and teach people to do that and use that and effectively kind of create a new style of programming in that language.
JavaScript was considered a toy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm relatively new to the R community, but R was considered the domain of pure academics.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, yeah, the parallel is really there. I want to talk for a second about API design and software design.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat in your dplyr talk yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things that struck me is that, so dplyr is completely written in C++, is that correct?
Mostly.
So it was interesting because from a software engineering standpoint, you're now flipping things upside down a little, and you're using the R... You're calling into R as an API, and you've built your own mini runtime,
mm-hmm.
For dplyr.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you having to fight R for that?
It's not too bad. I mean, I think that's the sort of the interesting thing about, like, domain specific languages. Like, once you've kind of embedded them, and you have, like, sort of there's a terribly formal specification, but there's some specification of what that language is. Then it's much easier to convert that to multiple different backends. And, you know, that's a dplyr, if you're working with a data frame, that's all C++ code that Romain Francois has written. If you're working with a database, and it's translated to SQL, and that runs on that ability, because you've got this kind of this language that is limited in scope, it's much easier to translate that to efficient C++ code or to SQL than to say, well, take all of R and make that efficient. Like, that's a big challenge.
So a lot of what you do is you build abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell, that
yes.
seems to be a lot
yep.
of what you do. So one of the critiques of abstractions is that all abstractions are leaky.
Yep.
So for dplyr in particular, we spoke yesterday about arrange.
Yep.
Arrange does not take into account the locale ordering
yeah.
inside of R.
Yeah.
And I actually was thinking about it last night, and I thought I could take some dplyr code, and sorting a data frame would sort one way, but if my backend was a database,
mm-hmm.
and that database had its own locale settings, the arrange would actually come back different.
Yep.
So I'm curious, as a software engineer, as a software developer, you have some tools and methods that you're using to sort of manage these leaky
yeah.
abstractions. Can you talk to me a little bit about what does your environment look like? What tools do you use to manage these abstractions and just to manage your regular workflow as a developer?
That's a possibly difficult question to answer, but so certainly, like, my everyday tools are easy to answer. I mean, that's RStudio, which honestly I've only really started using seriously in the last 18 months.
What did you use before then?
I used Sublime Text 2 and the terminal and just copying and pasting stuff
okay.
between them.
The old-fashioned way.
Yep. And it certainly helps having, like, the ear of RStudio developers when there's features that I would really like in RStudio.
Yeah.
But, I mean, RStudio, I think the, like, RStudio projects have been incredibly useful for me, and I often have, like, you know, 4 or 5 RStudio projects running simultaneously. Git, I think unit testing has been really important for me. Like, once I get to the point where I don't really understand how things work anymore, it's really nice to have unit tests so we don't accidentally break things. You know, I also do spend quite a lot of time just kind of, like, thinking about how the way things should work and kind of, like, writing up little kind of examples of code and the output, how it should work, and sort of thinking through all the combinations. And you know, some of that's mostly on the computer now, but I will still sometimes sketch things out on pen and paper. That's just easier.
Do you use Knitter?
Yes, for that, I guess that's another big change, is that I like all my vignettes are now in R Markdown. In fact, I don't think I ever wrote a Swede vignette, but I've now written at least like 15 R Markdown vignettes of various sizes. I just find R Markdown so much easier to write in, because you don't have to worry. Again, it's like this constraint. Like, I can't worry about all this fancy formatting, so I don't. Like, yeah. That's the beauty of R Markdown.
Markdown is a domain-specific language. Yeah. It's the same exact thing. They've winnowed down the things you have to worry about. You mentioned unit testing. Mm-hmm. So some programming languages have a glorious culture of unit testing.
Yes.
And a history. I don't believe R does. I could be wrong. Can you sort of explain to me how you approach unit testing in R?
So I think there's sort of a useful parallel between like exploratory data analysis and confirmatory data analysis. So exploratory, you sort of don't have a priori question necessarily, or the question's really vague, and you have to do sort of a lot of, you know, try a lot of things out and they fail. And whereas confirmatory data analysis, you kind of, you know, you have like a hypothesis in mind, you've collected the data for that, and now you're going to run a test that you knew in advance you were going to do. And I think there's sort of a similar role in programming. Like, a lot of the programming I do is exploratory. Like, I don't know how the code should work or how the API should feel. And unit testing is basically hopeless for that, because it forces you into like a set API, and then making changes to that is really hard. So I kind of think of like unit testing as like confirmatory data analysis. So when you know what the result should be a priori, then it's really useful to write a test first, because in an automated way you can check it out, check that it works. And I think generally, like, the way I think of unit testing is that, you know, when you write a function, you test it. Like, you try it out with some different inputs. Yeah. Like, you don't just write a function and then you're like, well, I did it correctly.
<That's> it.
You run it out, you know, you try it out with a few different inputs. And to me, all unit testing is making that process formal and automated, so you can run it and automatically see whether the results are correct or not. And so, like, the goal of the test that package, for example, is to make that shift from informal to formal testing as painless as possible.
Well, what was the package again?
Test that.
Test that. I'm unfamiliar with the test that package.
It's basically a unit testing package for R. So, you know, in some programming languages, this like discipline of test-driven development is very popular. I think that's great if you know what you're going to do. But that's not I don't think that's a great fit most of the time for data analysis or writing data analysis tools, because you don't know in advance what the right answer is.
That's why it's analysis.
Yeah. And so I like, unit testing is clearly really important for programming. It seems like maybe there could be some role for unit testing and data analysis too, in terms of like, it seems like it would be nice to be able to make explicit your expectations of the data, so that if those expectations are violated, you find out straight away. And I know there's a package called TestDat that came out of the R OpenSci hackathon earlier in the year, that sort of provides some ways, I think, to make assertions about what you expect your data to look like and how it should behave, and then if those expectations are violated, you find out about it right away.
Cool. So R is a programming language.
Mm-hmm.
R is an entire business community.
Mm-hmm.
R is also a people community.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any feeling for what the R people community needs to do in order to grow and change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting how the kind of R people community has changed. Because I think, like, for a long time, that was basically R help was like the main way that R users kind of got together online. But certainly the sort of the conventions of R help are not that friendly to newcomers.
I was warned to stay away from R help when I started my journey. I was explicitly told, you're better off not going to R help right now.
So I think Stack Overflow has become a great resource, although I think there's a little bit of the same thing going on. Like, very early on, Stack Overflow was extremely friendly, but now there's a lot of conventions, and people, like, it just gets frustrating when you see the same question asked over and over and over again, and it seems like the people asking the question have made no effort to find out what the answer is themselves.
You'd think there'd be some sort of machine learning model that could find that previous question.
It turns out, I think that's a really hard problem, though, because people, like, express the... And I think that's something that takes a while. Like, becoming an expert programmer in many ways is part of that is recognizing when two problems that seem quite different are actually the same problem. And certainly, like, I sometimes look at questions and I'm like, it's so obvious to me that this is exactly the same as this other question, even though there are, like, three important details that are different. So it's sort of hard, like, on Stack Overflow even, like, what's the generality of a question and when do you say one question is a duplicate of another? That's a hard question to answer. But certainly, like, Stack Overflow, I think the R meetups, like, that's a sort of a fantastic thing that's only happened relatively recently. Now, if you live in a, you know, big city and even a lot of smaller cities, there's somewhere you can go and hang out with like-minded people and hear about R courses.
We have a fantastic R meetup culture here in Los Angeles. That's really been a lot of what's fostered my development as an R programmer. So you said some really neat things about becoming an expert programmer. So if you could go back in time, right, and either give yourself some advice early on in your career as not just a developer, but a developer focused in this space, is there any particular advice that you'd like to synthesize either to a young you or to somebody watching this video online who is interested in becoming a data scientist, interested in programming in R, and you want to give them a leg up, a little step forward, as what is a bit of advice that they should take?
So I think the main thing is to understand the value of frustration. Like, when you're learning something new, you are going to be frustrated early on. And, like, that's actually really important. Like, if you want to get physically fit, right, you know, like, you have to push yourself. Your body is going to say, I am way too tired to do this now. And you have to kind of train yourself to, like, push past that a little bit further. And every day you push yourself a little bit more, then you get fitter. And I think frustration is, like, the equivalent for your brain. Like, when you're trying something that's mentally hard, you get frustrated. And you have to recognize that frustration is actually a good sign. It means you're, like, pushing your limits.
Yeah.
And so it's really natural. And if you're not getting frustrated, I think that that's a bad sign. That means you're not pushing yourself hard enough. So I think that's the biggest piece of advice I would give, is that you have to expect to be frustrated, and that's a good thing. It's obviously painful, but it's something that everyone experiences, that, you know, I have had countless hours of, like, frustration with R and just banging my head against the wall, and that happens to everyone. But if you keep doing that, if you keep working at it over time, you get better and you become fluent and you become an expert.
Easy growth is not necessarily valuable growth, right? So absolutely, frustration is the metric you should measure to a great degree. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you'd like to say?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, I guess I'd like to, you know, express... So one of the things that I find most satisfying about my job is, like, hearing from other people about how they're using R and my tools to do stuff. And I absolutely love coming to use R and talking to people and finding out, like, all sorts of crazy things that they're using R for. And I really enjoyed this interview.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks.
Cheers.